You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Do you like what you're hearing right now? Then be sure to check out VOC Nation. Whether it's on VOCNation.com or your favorite podcast provider, VOC Nation offers the greatest in live and on-demand content, great interviews, and incredible insight from those who have lived the business. 7 days a week, VOCNation.com. And don't forget to check us out on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Welcome to another edition of Bumps and Thumps, the Talk of Wrestling. I'm Brian Ferguson. My guest today really does not need an introduction. He has been a star of pro wrestling from the 1970s through the late 90s. He has been a member of the Fabulous Ones. He was known as Gator and even Doink the Clown. And I have my partner in crime today. Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, let me introduce Mr. Steve Kern. And welcome back, Mr. George Shire. Steve, thanks
hey,
for coming
how you
on
doing?
Today.
Well, Brian, and I thanks for also having me on.
You bet. I wanted to also mention your book, Kern Chronicles, Volume 1, The Fabulous Life of Steve Kern. There it is.
There it is. There
now,
it is.
Before,
on,
there,
on Amazon.
Mine's on order. Mine's on order yeah. as I speak to
now,
you.
I want you
I hope you enjoy it.
Oh, I know I will. I followed your career, Steve, from 72, 73, when you that's when you were breaking in the business.
And, okay, well, I appreciate it.
And I don't know. I think we're the same age, you and I.
How old are you?
72, born in September, 51.
Okay. Now, you're a lot older than me, George.
Thanks a lot.
No, I was born 1951 in September also. I am 72.
What day in September? Let's get really weird here.
We're on, me and Don Morocco have the same day. It's the 10th.
Okay, 17th.
Okay. Well, I'm older than you.
You're older than me.
Yeah, I sure am. My Graham was on the 22nd, and all the way through high school and through our whole lives, he would always call me on my birthday and say, "What's going on, old man?" Like, you know, I'm only 12 days older than you, Mike. But anyway, yeah, age never really affected me. I don't know. It's kind of weird when you grow older because that. You know, I still look through the eyes of a 20-year-old sometimes or a 30 or 40 or whatever until I go by a mirror and I go, holy crap, who's that old guy?
Who the hell is that in there? Yeah. Or sometimes just getting out of bed in the morning and realizing that you got to do it in sections to make sure everything's put together.
Yeah, I just roll out to hit the floor.
Steve, if we could.
Yes, sir.
We were talking a story a minute ago before your action figure here from the AWA with Stan. And we'd love to hear that story again about when you were in the toy store. Talk to us about that if you would.
Oh, okay. Well, it was really weird because nobody had ever had action figures. I mean, you know, so far as in the wrestling industry. And we were in the AWA and you know, they approached us, Vern did, and everybody, and then we met with an artist and all this stuff. And then when they came out, I went to Toys R Us. And when I went into Toys R Us, they had this huge display, right? And I go up, and it was a big rack, and it had all the Fabulous Ones, the Road Warriors, some other jabroni tag teams, but these two I remembered. And I reached behind them, and I scooped all the Fabulous Ones out, and I put them in a basket. I was so excited, man. I was like a little kid. I mean, yeah. I was only 30, and at 72, that is a little kid. But I'm going like, oh, my gosh. And I couldn't wait. I got up to the counter, and I started putting them on the counter, and the guy looks at me, right? And he gives me this dead look, kind of a Minneapolis look. He gave me this dead-ass look, and he says, oh, you must be a big wrestling fan, huh? And I'm going, oh, no, that's me, man. And he's just looked at me, and he looked at the doll, and he goes, no way. And I'm going, wait a minute. And I pull my driver's license out, and I said, read that name. And he goes, well, spell this way, boy, must be your name. I said, that's me. What do you think I'm buying all these? Lo and behold, here's the deal. Now, what, however long ago that was, 84, so 40 years, somewhere yeah. in that, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
When I bought them, I think they were like $395 or $495 a piece. And now I've Ooh. Seen them on, I've seen them on eBay as high as yeah. $1,500, and that's not even signed. Yeah. I have in my collection, I kept everything I was ever a part of, every program, every wrestling yeah. magazine. I kept it all. I'm going to take it a step farther, and a lot of people are going to steal this from me. But I kept all that stuff, and what I did was I kept five of them that were not opened. I mean, you know, I had them little action figures all over the house. Me and Stan had them in the car. We'd take wow. the Road Warriors, tie a bootlace to them, and throw them out the window. Drag them back in.
Oh, that's right.
I'd cover both of them on the dash, and Stan would count them out. I mean, we punished Hawk and Animal. I mean, you know, with those little figures. But what I was going to say is, keeping all that stuff, most people would have never thought to keep the unopened packages, because yeah. That collecting wasn't a thing of that era.
Yeah.
Well, this is another thing that happened to me, and this is what everybody's going to steal that watches a show that's in the wrestling business. And I encourage them to do this. But Mike Graham's daughter approached me after he had died, and mm-hmm. there's nobody left. Mike's son committed suicide. His dad committed suicide. His grandfather committed suicide, and Mike committed suicide. His daughter, Nicole, the only surviving family, the Gossett's wrestler named Graham, comes to me like I'm like an uncle to her, and I'm the only mm-hmm. kind of that connection in the wrestling business. And she says, Steve, what do I do with all of this stuff from my dad and my grandpa? I've got so much stuff that they collected over the years. And I said, Nicole, let me just ask you to go through the stuff and see if they signed anything. Did they sign any of it? Mm-hmm. Because a picture is just a picture. If it's not autographed with authenticity, yeah. it's just another picture. It can be reproduced. So what I did was, a big light bulb went off in my head. Well, not that big, but a big enough one. We don't have anything in our house that represents wrestling. Everything that I have that kind of resembles wrestling is in the garage, including pictures on the wall and stuff, but nothing in the house. But I went out in the garage, and I brought all this stuff in the house. And I have these big plastic containers with all these magazines and pictures and Japan stuff and every territory thing and program. And I signed everything I have. As a matter of fact, if you look through the book when you get it and you see pictures of them, that you're going to see where I've signed it when they reproduce the picture in the book. Right. And it's a question of, why did he sign that picture? The reason I signed it, hey, I'm not going to be around forever, and anything mm-hmm. that I have has zero value. But now, even if it's just a little bit of a boost, and any of my kids or grandkids want to, you know, get rid of some of the stuff, at least it's autographed. Since I started that, whenever I do a wrestling con or an autograph signing or whatever, and any of my friends are there or sitting beside me or whatever, I sit and I tell them the story. And yeah. every one of them kind of looks at me and goes, you know what? That's a good idea.
Yeah.
And I'm going, you know, I would have never thought of it if it hadn't been for Mike Graham's daughter saying, what's my dad's stuff worth? And I said, yeah. I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, you know, so
Yeah.
Well,
wow.
The thing is, it still has some value. That, you know, anything that's old programs, photos, etc. I mean, I can tell you that. But you nailed it. If it's autographed, I mean, that definitely, if someone is collecting, that adds to the value. It just literally does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every time I go to see Stan, if I find something in my collection that he hasn't signed, I put it in a suitcase and say, hey, you need to sign these things. You know, sure. He's had open heart surgery. You never know when your partner's going.
Stan has?
Yes.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yes.
He's doing fine, though, I hope.
No, he's in great health. I was just at an autograph thing with him and Tom Pritchard on Saturday. And he's in great health. He just doesn't like to fly. So you have to do something. If you're going to do something with him, it has to be within driving range of Greensboro. Sure. That's what the deal is.
You know, since you mentioned Stan, you know, I really liked you guys as a team. I mean, I thought you were great.
Well, thanks.
The whole shtick was new to me with the videos and stuff. But I really, because I'm a tag team lover since I was a kid. I love tag teams because there's so many stories that can be told in a tag team. And one of the things that was weird when you guys came in, I had made trips down to Florida several times in the late 70s, the very early 80s. And I remember one of the first matches that I saw at the Fort Hesterly Armory was Stan Lane and Brian St. John. And the night I saw him, I didn't know if they were heels or babies. And, you know, that was before you guys. But there was one match where you were teamed. Trying to think. You were teamed with Mike Graham. And you went against Stan Lane and Brian St. John in one of the matches I saw. And then when I saw you come in as Stan's partner, I thought, this is cool. I saw these guys wrestle against each other, you know, and.
Yeah, Stan was brand new in the business when he came to Florida.
Yeah.
You know, he got Ric Flair helped him get in. He met Ric Flair at the beach where he was a bouncer. And, you know, anyway, he came into Florida and they teamed him up with Brian St. John. And Mike Graham and I were partners. And the education was in our industry, it's pretty simple. I mean, the veteran. Whoever's got the most time and the most matches and the most experience controls everything.
Right.
Most of the time in territorial days, the heels called the matches and the baby faces followed. But when it come down to Stan and I wrestling against each other, I was calling the match. And one of the funniest stories was, and he just brought it up this weekend telling Tom Pritchard, as he said, the first time I wrestled Steve, he backed me in the ropes in Miami. And he goes, 1-2. Well, a 1-2 is where I hit you and you hit me back. Well, Stan hit me twice. He goes, 1-2.
Oh. I go, oh.
So I answered that, well, 3 then. And I won't say the language I used with that. But then I said, well, 3 then. And I went, whop. And Stan goes, I learned a lesson that night. Steve taught me what 1-2 was.
Didn't he even wrestle for a little bit when he first started as Stan Flair for some matches?
Now that I can't answer. I'm not positive.
I seem to recall that there was, because I know that Flair had a little bit to do with it, but I know I've got some results where Stan was Flair. Pretty sure.
Well, it could have been, but there again, that's one thing that I've learned in doing things and, especially in my life. I mean, you know, at 50 years old, I had an enlightening in life, and I accepted Jesus Christ, and I decided I was never going to lie again. I'm not going to lie again. And my business comes with a lot of lies. I mean, you're lying to the public. You're lying about what you're doing. But the only two people I lied to the most was my wife and my mother. And so I said, that's it. I'm not doing it. So if I don't know something or I wasn't an actual eyewitness to it, I won't even half the time I won't even comment. I mean, I've got friends that actually do podcasts that they embellish on stories that they act like they were there. I mean, you know, I've been a part of the story and they're telling the story and I'm looking at them like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I was there. That didn't happen. You're telling a story and it's not true. So that was my excuse for all of that. But my idea is that, you know, it's easy to tell the truth because you don't have to rehearse it or you don't have to remember it. It's always going to be the truth. So, yeah. But now that I'm not employed, I have only two bosses, God and my wife. I'm a loose cannon. I mean, when Triple H saw me the other night at Royal Rumble, he comes over to me and he hugs me and he said, Steve, everything's changed here. It's a whole new place. We're gonna really honor the legends. They gave us a suite with Hogan, all of us in a suite at Royal Rumble. And wow. I'm going, you know what? That really sounds great. And I really hope that's true. But I'm not a big trusting person in this business. I mean, you know, I've been through it. I mean, you know,
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
A lot of times it's that Eddie Graham taught me this, and I had to pull it on Jerry Jarrett. Eddie Graham says, kid, when they put their arm around your shoulder and start patting you on the back, they're most likely taking you to the cliff and get ready to shove your ass off. So this is what you do. When they put his arm around your back, you put your arm up under his arm and hook up over. And I remember Jerry Jarrett, when we really got over as the Fabulous Ones and we were doing really good business. I mean, it was a good time. It wasn't just an individual thing. It was just the right timing for all of that. When we really do a good business, he come up to me and put his arm around my back, you know, and he's walking me down through the entrance to the Memphis Coliseum. And he's going, you know, Steve, we got a lot of plans for you and all that. And I reached up under him and I hooked my arm back up under his back. And he goes, what are you doing? I said, Jerry, if you're taking me to the cliff, Eddie Graham taught me a long time ago, your ass is going with me.
That's great.
You know what? He just busted out laughing, and it was almost like, this kid knows too much.
Yeah.
This guy. You know? But when I was in the business, was a sponge. I just sponged off of everything. Yeah. I wanted to know everything. I mean, you know, Jack Briscoe was my mentor in Harley. Yeah. Both of them taught me, watch every match. When you're done with your match, go back out there and watch every match. See who's getting over, how they're getting over, what the crowd likes, what kind of story they're telling, what kind of movement are they making. And then this is the secret that I taught when I owned the developmental for Vince, the FCW. I taught all my students to steal five things from five people that you admire, that you watched. Whenever, when you're a kid, now, whatever, steal one thing from each person that you really like, and you've got you, and it's a proven product. Now, I told them, this is why I always finish the story with them, especially at FCW, I'd say, don't go out there and steal standing in a corner and raising your eyebrow. Sure. That's not a move. I mean, you know, and don't try to imitate somebody to perfection, because that's a cheap imitation.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you say that steal from others, because I had actually talked with Vern Gagne about that many, many years ago. And he used to train the guys, different guys through the years, you know, like the Anderson brothers and Blackjack Mulligan and Ric Flair and so many others. And Vern always said, the thing I need to do once I get these guys in the business, he says, I got to send them on the road. I got to get them to another territory so they can pick up from other boys. They got to learn new holds or learn things that work for them, things that don't work for them. So you're saying the same thing. And that's why I think if you looked at the landscape of professional wrestling in the 70s and the 80s, the early 80s, there were so many wrestlers in all these territories. And a lot of them were Vern Gagne students that right. were making, you know, Ricky Steamboat and Flair, of course. And like I said,
the Nasty Boys.
The Nasty yeah. Boys. Larry, you know, Larry Hennig earlier, Baron Von Raschke, Kurt Hennig. Greg Gagne and I figured out there were over 100 of them one time that have come wow. out of Vern's camp. So you did your lessons well. And I mean, it showed in your work.
Well, here's the thing, George. It wasn't me. It was me listening to people that
exactly.
had
exactly being a sponge.
And that I admired. To yeah. watch Jack, to watch Jack Briscoe wrestle in a 1 hour Broadway with anybody, yeah. anybody was yeah. like a wrestling lesson. And I had the opportunity to wrestle Harley to like 4 or 5 1 hour Broadways in Florida. It was like wow. going to college. Yeah. I mean, you know, I admired him so much. It was like really, it made me nervous. I remember the first time I worked with him was in Tampa and we went an hour. And when we went out there, I mean, you know, I knew Harley, I've been around Harley, but I wasn't on his level. And now all of a sudden I'm on a level for a world title. And he's going, okay, kid. And that was back when we used to get our hands checked and our waistline checked and the bottom of our boot checked. And the referee's standing there and he's going, all right, kid, lock up, take a headlock, shoot me off, give me one tackle, drop flat, leapfrog, hip toss me. I'll powder to the floor, follow me out to the floor. We'll round 2 turnbuckles, come back in. You drop flat, I'll hit the ropes. You give me a hip toss, I'll kick out. I'll go to, you go to drop an elbow, I'll move. I'll get up, go to drop an elbow, you move. And I'm going, what? I'm a nervous wreck. I'm a nervous wreck. And he just called a 10-minute high spot.
Yeah.
And then he turns and looks at me. He says, whatever you do, and I'm not going to use the language, but he said, don't up this. Don't mess this up. Now, really, the pressure's on. And I can remember going through it almost like it's yesterday. And as I'm making the movement, I'm going, oh, man, I sure hope I get this right, because I know he's left-handed. And whenever I wrestle guys left-handed, I'm leery, because you get so used to getting hit with a right hand that all of a sudden you're sticking your face in front of a left when these guys throw a left. So I go, uh-oh, Harley's going to knock me out before the bell rings. Anyway.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. When you speak of Harley and Jack Briscoe, I mean, I know of them so well. And
all right.
guys like that you were in the ring with and often, were there guys, Steve, that you just wanted to work with, you would every night if you could, or were there some that you said, oh God, I got to get in with this one? And I don't mean you to out anybody really, but
that was both ways. I mean, you know, there was guys that, here's the thing. When you're a young guy, wrestling, first of all, two things. Wrestling is an opinion. Everybody has an opinion on what they think's good and bad. And it's all based on their experiences and what they've witnessed and what they've been kind of controlled, brainwashed to in their area. The other side of it is when you're wrestling guys, there's guys that are generous and there's guys that are going to help you out there. Then there's guys that are going to really not really do anything to help you. They're going to just be all about themselves.
Sure.
Because reality about pro wrestling is we're playing a schoolyard game called King on the Mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In that locker room, in that arena, with that promoter, we're playing King on the Mountain. And a lot of guys say we're climbing a ladder. Well, we're more than climbing a ladder. We're trying to come up a mountain from all kinds of directions to get that main event spot and the largest amount of money.
Yeah.
So some of them are on that mountain and they're kicking you down, and they're deliberately kicking you down because you're inexperienced, you're green, and they take advantage of you.
Yeah.
Then there was another group that were educators, because my first 5 years in the wrestling business, I was considered green, and I did probably 95% jobs. But I never had a bad face when they said, oh, you got to get beat. No problem. This was business. I can do it. I'll do the best I can. And when I'd offer, I built a rapport in that dressing room with other people because of Jack and because of Harley. Just be generous. Mm-hmm. You're on a learning curve. And I'd say, whatever you want to do, whatever you want to do. And when you were that generous to them, that automatically made them either like you or take advantage of you. 90% of the time, they liked you well enough that that's basically how my career moved forward, by being a guy that was willing to get beat and willing to do the job and willing to do it at the best of my ability and make it look like it wasn't, you know, just a slaughter. The other side of it was, is when it got to be my turn, and all of a sudden they're having to do a job for me, I turned right back around and I treated it the same way, because I'd been in that guy's shoes of getting beat by me. And and when they'd say, well, you gotta get beat. And then they'd say, well, make it a competition, Steve. So, well, how long you want me to go? So go 30 minutes. I knew in my heart I could tell a story and make whoever I wrestled with look stronger than when they stepped in the ring to begin with. Because I just barely beat him. I didn't just eat him up. And once you got to a certain level, especially being out of Florida or AWA, you were a wrestler. You weren't, you know, like a New York guy or a Tennessee guy. You could control the match and you could control your opponent. They had this natural psychology of, then they said, where's Kern from? Well, he's from Florida. Boom, a light goes off, because they know how hard it is to break in this territory. You had to get beat. I had to get beat up for 6 months. And my dad was a prisoner in Vietnam. And I'd come home to my mom, and my mom would see my face and she'd go, what happened to you? And I go, these are Matt burns, mom, on my nose and my ears and my elbows and my knees. And she goes, honey, she'd say, honey, I thought wrestling was fake. And I said, Mom, so did I. But whatever I'm learning down there at that sportatorium is real. And it was a way we were educated. We wrestled and we would shoot, and I couldn't shoot. I'm not a shooter, so I don't ever claim to be. But you had to shoot with Hiro Matsuda and Jack and Bob Roop,
I was going to say, would be a tough one.
Oh, and they didn't – nobody ever punched me right in my teeth and my face, but they punished me. And what it taught me was how to respect my business.
Right.
Eddie Graham had a law in this territory. If you're ever in a bar and somebody confronts you about reality and wrestling, you better win that fight or get a U-Haul. Yeah. He said, because you better fight, number one, for your business. And then if you lose, you better get a U-Haul. And so that was the rule.
Yeah. That's so interesting you say that, because, again, I know Vern Gagne and Eddie Graham were good friends. Uh-huh. And I know they talked often and they exchanged talent from time to time. And that very thing you just said, Vern always told the guys, he said, you go out, you get in a fight, you better win it. Because if you don't, don't come back to the office. Says, you're no longer here.
Yeah, because then everybody in town is going to know he beat up a wrestler.
Yeah.
I used to outsmart him, though. I kind of I got so good in the bars. I mean, you know. I learned the psychology of just having a dominant character. And when somebody approached me, because Don Curtis taught me the sleeper hold. And when you had a hold here in Florida, you had to shoot with the hold. So I learned the shooting sleeper hold. And Eddie would have me do at intermission, he'd have volunteers out of the audience come up to the audience and wanted to go put through the sleeper hole. And I'd be nervous because I'm going, well, I've done it every time, no problem. But what about one time? And it never happened. But, you know, with those kind of things, when it come time to the fight, I mean, you know, example, we have a little part of Tampa called Ybor City. It's kind of all bars and a rough little bit of an area. And And me and Dusty would go in there real late at night. And a guy pulls up beside me at a bar and just leans into me and goes, well, hey, what do you think about a karate guy against a wrestler? And I'm looking at the guy, right? And I'm going, are you talking about me and you? And the guy says, I just ask you a question. And immediately I went from Mr. Nice Guy to a real dominating force. And, you know, when you rush somebody and get right up in their face and say, let's go right now. It just kind of puts that doubt in their mind as, well, wrestling may not be real, but this guy's pretty sure of himself. So, like I said, I wasn't a shooter, but I grew up in a rough, area. Myself, Hulk Hogan, Mike Graham, Dick Slater, Austin Idol, we all went to high school together.
Was Kevin Sullivan part of that too?
No, but Kevin Sullivan came into the territory early in our careers and was Mike Graham's first partner.
Right.
Okay.
But Kevin's a tough. Kevin's double tough. I've seen Kevin beat up a lot of people. And I didn't even know he was that tough. One time he scared me. And I said, he pulled the guy's nose and ripped the nose off. And I'm going, oh, my God. He was like from Boston. And he says, yeah, I'm your Dick Slater from Boston.
I want to share a quick story with you about your buddy Harley Race when you talk about being tough. In 1965, in February, Harley was pretty young. He was just 20 something at the time, and he had went to a bar after the wrestling card in Minneapolis. He had went to a place called the Chestnut Tree. It was a hangout here in Minneapolis downtown, and there were three guys beating up on a lady in the bar. Now, I don't know if the lady was a stripper or what the deal was, but there were three guys pounding on. The manager of the strip of the Chestnut Tree came to Harley and asked if he could intervene. He knew he was a wrestler. Harley went up, and this is a true story. It made the newspapers. Harley got up. He took out two of the guys. I mean, he popped them, knocked them down. Another guy came up behind him, the third guy, and he got Harley in the back. It was on the right-hand side. Got him in the back with a knife. And Harley went down, went to the hospital. He's out of action legitimately for, you know, about 4 weeks, three, four weeks. The moral of the story is that Harley was a heel. He was handsome Harley Race in those days, teamed with pretty boy Larry Hennig. So they had heat like you would.
There's another tough guy.
Yeah. They had heat like you wouldn't believe, you know, because they were face of Hercules, or mind of Einstein and the body of Hercules and all that crap they threw out. So he's in the hospital, and it made the Minneapolis paper, St. Paul papers, and I have the clippings. He comes back after his injury, and the very first night on TV, he was introduced. The TV audience, 100 people, whatever they had, they cheered like you wouldn't believe Harley Race. The bell rang. Harley went in first in the tag match, and I kid you not, within 10 seconds, that entire audience was booing Harley Race again. And Harley said later, he said, I had to get my heat back. I couldn't let that crowd think I'm a good guy. But
Harley was not a baby face.
He had that scar for the rest of his life. It was a moon-shaped scar on the back, and it stayed with him the rest of his life.
Well, I had a lot of real experiences with Harley in Atlanta. He had me come in, and he had me and Ricky Gibson and somebody else come down and shoot with some marks. And I saw him there chase a guy out the building and right into the street and broke his arm right in front of me. But here's the one that really got me about Harley, and I wasn't there. It's when they were going to rob that restaurant. I don't know if you ever heard that story, but Harley was in a restaurant, and two guys come in to rob the place. And they went around to all the people sitting at tables, and they were saying, give me your watch, give me your ring, give me your wallet, give me your wife's diamond ring. And they got to Harley, and the one guy was at the door watching the door, and the guy got to Harley, and he said, give me your watch. And Harley said, nah. And then he told him, give him his ring. Nah. And then he told him, give me your wallet. Nah. And the guy says, you give it to me, I'm going to shoot you. He said, you're not going to have a chance. And Harley hooked that gun, rammed that guy, and run him right into the other guy out through the door and beat the shit out of both of them, and they both got arrested. I think that was in St. Joe, Missouri.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing happened with Mr. Saito. Mr. Saito was in a restaurant minding his own business, and somebody came up from behind to rob that place, and it was a Japanese or a Chinese restaurant in California. And they went to rob it, and Saito's right there, and they pushed him out of the way. And you remember, Mr. Saito was a cool guy, but you don't push him. And when the guy pushed him, he saw the gun, he knocked the gun down and suplexed the guy, and he became a big hero, and he was a heel too.
Sure.
And, you know, so there's a couple of those stories that, you know, stuck out in my mind that I wasn't an eyewitness to, but I heard them 100 times, and I actually heard Harley actually told me the story about the restaurant. I mean, he used a little bit different language than I'm using, but he emphasized words when he would say, not my wallet, not my wallet. I mean, you know, not my wife. My wife's not going to give you her ring either. So
well, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say that if they were in a fight, they'd want Harley to have their back. He was legit tough. He didn't know fear.
Yeah, I have a couple of those guys. Haku. He's real close friend of mine. What I was smart enough to do, and you know, this is just psychology. I wasn't a shooter, but I was best friends with all of them. Sure. And I mean, I was close to all of them, and I would do anything for them. They're my brothers and I love them.
Yeah.
But if you were really to do something to Steve Kern, you're going to be answering to some seriously tough guys in the wrestling business because that they wouldn't appreciate that. And even the Road Warriors, the night I double-crossed them there in Minneapolis, when we came to the ring and Billy Robinson and Kurt's dad, Larry the Axe, and, I mean, you know, Brad Rheingans and all of them are telling them, don't mess with the Fabs. And, I mean, you know, it's like, I made a lot of really good friends, and it really boils down to being humble.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I teach, and I've taught more people in wrestling than anybody in history because that I ran the developmental and ran schools since 81. And what I always teach is it's a simple thing. Treat people the way you want to be treated.
Exactly.
And you want to get along in that dressing room. Don't come in with a cocky, arrogant attitude thinking that that's going to get over because there's a lot of people in that dressing room you're going to find out that are tougher than you and they don't want that. Come in with an attitude of, man, what did your mom teach you? Just treat people the way you want to be treated. And I was always a humble guy. I mean, when the night we showed up in Minneapolis, I remember opening the dressing room door and I jerked it real quick back. And I looked at Stan, I said, uh-oh. And Stan was nervous with me because of my history, right? And he goes, what? And I said, I've ribbed every one of those guys when they came to Florida, especially Billy Robinson. And they're all shooters. And he goes, great. And I said, I said, don't worry, I got this. So when we walked back in the dressing room, it was funny because when they stood up, there was some stiff looks because I really ribbed some serious ribs with alligators and stuff down here in Florida. But I dropped to my knees in front of all of them and I said, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to rib you when they came to Florida. It was just so easy. It's all my fault. I swear. You can do anything. I'll get you hot dogs. I said, I'll go buy you anything you want anytime we're working. I mean, you know, Stan will give you all of his girlfriends. I said, you know, and all of them started laughing. But then they all started telling the ribs that I'd pulled on them, you know, and so.
Yeah. Anyway. I wanted to ask you.
Oh, go ahead, Brad. Go.
Thanks. Steve, I wanted to ask you, I've watched some of those matches with you and Stan against the Road Warriors, even when you were baby faces, and when there was a match in particular, I remember, in Winnipeg, you all did with the Road Warriors. You were the heel team for there. Were they, I mean, it looked like they were really pounding you guys and vice versa. Was there really heat between all four of you guys, or was it just... Mm-hmm. Absolutely
not. It was a very professional environment.
Okay.
Where I'm from and my style is I'm a stiff worker.
Okay.
I believe, especially two moves. If I slap you, you better have your mouth shut because I'm going to slap crap out of you. If I chop you, I'm going to put my hand, hit you so hard, I'm going to leave print on your back because those two moves are not damaging. But I was taught in my history in wrestling, like I said earlier about wrestling has opinions. I was taught in my education that the audience has come to go on a ride. And they want to be told a story and they want to leave their life behind and get caught up in a story of good versus evil. And they want it to be believable. They don't want to see a bunch of hokey stuff where you're barely touching each other.
Yeah.
I mean, we laid it in. The thing is you got to remember the whole scenario is when you walk out in your underwear in front of thousands and thousands of people, your level of intensity goes up like 99%. And the feeling you get, you feel no pain. I mean, you feel no pain. I mean, you know, there's a sudden jolt when you break something and you realize you can't get up. But other than that, now the next day is another story. But I mean, Hawk and Joe wasn't as stiff as Hawk. Hawk really liked to go at it. But I think it was more he was green than he, I mean, you know, because it, when, you know, I witnessed it the very first time we wrestled in Memphis, you know, where I grabbed an arm on Hawk. And when I took his arm, he's got his arm stuck out. I'm twisting it and he's just looking at me and he's going, he's not selling nothing. I mean, so I go, well, you're not going to sell your arm. It's a big arm. I get it and all that. I'm taking you down. And I took him down and I worked his leg. Well, when you're on your back, and I don't care how big you are, you can't be that strong because the guy keeps taking your legs out from under you and keeps working them. Then you have to react to it. So Hawk would get mad at me because he knew that I could outsmart him when he wasn't selling his arm or a headlock was like a waste of movement. But at the same time, he gained respect for me because he said, well, one thing about Kern, he's smart enough to know how to make me sell. He'll take me down. And I said, I don't want to do that. I really don't want to do that. I would rather work standing up, but I saw it. I mean, you know, Stan and I were pretty jacked. I mean, you know, we got pretty big. Yeah. Being influenced by them. And so, you know, we got to where we could hold our own. So it wasn't like they were doing the only thing like Bobby Heenan was really, really loved us, but he had Nick Bockwinkel and Mr. Saito. And Nick Bockwinkel would say things like, ah, these guys look like two guys that fell off of a cake in San Francisco, a couple of gay guys, you know, and Bobby Heenan says, you know what? That's pretty funny now, Nick, but I understand Kern's a big ribber. I mean, you know, keep it up, you know. So, no, I never ribbed Nick.
Yeah.
You know, I had respect for him.
No, I was just going to say, you guys, when your matches, because I remember him as a kid, you know, I was a teenager in the 80s, and I just remember they look so real, which is good. That's still your job.
Which is good. You want real.
But it looks so real. Like, you guys really did not like each other. Did not. You were in there to do a job, yes. But you guys really, you did it great because it was so believable to me. I mean, I was a teenager. I believed you guys, you know, and your other matches you had with those guys. You know, Long Riders, all those guys in the AWA in 84. 85.
Working with Bruiser Brody was like a night off for me, but working with Nick was a little hard because Nick was a loose worker and he didn't like me. I mean, he didn't like to feel me. I mean, you know, and I get it. And George asked a question earlier, was there guys you liked to work with, didn't like to work with? Well, it was better to ask somebody else because there was a lot of guys that didn't want to work with me. Honky Tonk Man, Wayne Ferris. I remember the first time I wrestled him in Tennessee. When we got done, he came in the back. He said, "Do I owe you money?" And I go, "What?" I go, "What?" And he said, "Man, you beat the hell out of me out there." I said, "Brother, my job is to make it look real. You know, the way I was taught, you guys can all make it look however you want to. And if you're not trying to get hurt, I get it. I'm not worried about getting hurt. I'm trying to protect my industry and my business. I want there to be the slightest doubt in somebody's mind when I get out of that ring and walk back to them people. Do you really want to jump that guy or not?" I mean, you know, in Chicago, one time the lights went off when we were being introduced. And me and Stan come out of the tunnel there at the Rosemont Horizon. And we're working against the Road Warriors in there in the ring already. And they hailed from Chicago, even though they weren't from Chicago. They always said there. And so they're over like Rover. And when we come through there, the tunnel, the light hit me and Stan in the face. And three guys jumped the fence right there and and attacked us. Well, and the light, I can't see, but nobody ever touched me. But the spotlight went off, and I'm looking right at this, and them Chicago cops right there, they beat the hell out of these three guys in the dark. And I mean, just beat them with billy clubs. And when the lights come on, there's me and Stan standing there and three guys laying on the floor, and cops are hooking up their ankles to handcuffs and dragging them down the ramp. And all of a sudden, we get the biggest pop ever. It's like, oh man, these guys are kind of fruity looking, but they just kicked the shit out of three guys.
Steve, let me ask you a question. Steve, I was going to ask you, when you, I think you came in Memphis before that.
Yes, sir.
Right? When you came into Vern and in 84, what was promised you or told of you, what they expected of you, what they were going to do with you? Was it intended that you might get the tag title? How was that working? Because the reason I ask is it seemed like, just from an observer standpoint at that time period, that you were getting the huge push, but it seemed to shift a little bit when the Warriors came in, the Road Warriors.
Well, here's the first thing, George. You really never know when the powers of control are doing. And even if they tell you they're doing something, you can believe probably 60% of it, you know. And then, I mean, you know, not to say they're all going to be lying to you, but they're trying to keep you there. That's the first thing. And they need opponents and stuff like that. And nobody really made us promises of belts or things like that, because to me, I got to be perfectly honest. I mean, I held over 50 titles. I'm the Florida heavyweight champion 5 times, and I'm the NWA World Junior Heavyweight Champion. Those are things that aren't really my merit. I didn't win that stuff. Yep. I was given that stuff. I was told to win that night. I was told to lose when I lost it. So I never really gave much effort. I mean, you know, much merit on belts. My thing was my check. Bottom line,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
People say, "Well, were you in it just for the money?" Absolutely not. I mean, it was a very thrilling life, and I mean, you know, I met a lot of unbelievable. They call them marks now, but I still call them fans, and I kind of feel that mark thing is an insult. They don't know it, but to me, I'm insulting them because that was behind the scene terms that we use. Yeah. And you hear my killer dog, he's blind. He's in there barking and there's nobody there. I don't know, but you'll have to put up with me. He's a little miniature dachshund. 14. No, he's deaf too, or I tell him to shut up, so it's not going to do any good. But belts have no meaning. I mean, you know, all of everything that does just to do with wrestling is fabricated. I mean, I've got friends, the Nasty Boys, we just mentioned a minute ago. Nobbs lives here. Sags lives here in Tampa. Well, there's 50 of us that live in this Tampa Bay area of guys, all generations. And Nobbs, I talked to Nobbs the other day, and his heart is broken that they haven't put him in the Hall of Fame yet. And he's going, "Man," he says, "before I die, I just want to be in the Hall of Fame." And he's crying on my shoulder. And see, I babysat those guys when nobody would take them. I brought them to Florida and we used them. But I said to Nobbs, this ain't real. I mean, you know, this is not real. You're worried about a Hall of Fame. There's about 10 Hall of Fames. But the other side of it is, if this was baseball and you had hit 9 million home runs and you'd caught about 400,000 flies and you didn't get put in the Hall of Fame, I get it. But everything that happened in this industry, no matter what it was, no matter what the belt was, I mean, when I did Skinner in the WWF, alligator poacher out of the Everglades, that was one of my favorite characters. And people say, well, you know, they never did nothing with Skinner, you know. And I go, well, that's not my fault. You know, I'm a homophobic. And they found out Pat Patterson, when he knew I was coming into the territory, I mean, you know, there was a big clash right away. And so, I mean, you know, I didn't see any big plans. It went back to this. What are you going to pay me? I don't care if you beat me. I don't care if I ever wear a title. If that's what I'm going to be remembered as, that, okay, well, you didn't do that good, or you're not in the Hall of Fame. I'm going, wait a minute. You're talking to a guy that trained the Bella Twins. The Bella Twins. Two skinny little girls that came from modeling to me and Tom Pritchard at FCW. We taught them. They went up to WWE. Next thing I know, they're being inducted in the Hall of Fame. So do you think that that's going to hurt my feelings? No, absolutely not, because I'm a realist. I get it. It's about drawing money, selling tickets, Hall of Fame, whatever it is, political, who knows. But Nimes is just like, it's killing him. It's killing him that they're not putting him in the Hall of Fame. And I told him, well, maybe he was friends with Shawn Michaels quite a bit, and Shawn Michaels is really tight with Triple H. And I mean, we were just at Royal Rumble, and Triple H was in such a, you know, kind of a different mode now that Vince was at, like, towering over him, that, you know, maybe now they'll loosen up a little bit and they'll think about some of you guys. I mean, you know, and I would really love to see him go in the Hall of Fame. But but I know how much they pay, and it's not that big a deal. If they gave you 50 grand in a Super Bowl ring, I'd be really crying the blues to you guys right now. Why am I not in the Hall of Fame? But that's not a big payoff. They give you a ring, and I mean, it's a great honor. Don't get me wrong, and I'm not knocking the whole thing. But, you know, Vince took this whole country and the world to another level on smartening everybody up.
Right.
But inevitably, he didn't smarten all the boys up. I mean, you know, to this day, guys will say, well, you know, well, I beat you over there. But wait a minute. You didn't beat me. Dusty was the booker. Dusty beat me, you know, so.
I like your comment about getting paid, because that is the bottom line. You could make a great living in a certain territory, and you could be in the mid card or be the jobber every week. You made good money. Nick Bockwinkel, you know him, and he came up with a perfect way to put that comment. He said one time he went into a territory and the promoter told him that he didn't want to have Nick Bockwinkel there. He was going to call. He says, is it okay if I call you Roy Diamond? And Nick responded, and he loved telling this story. He said, I responded to him, I don't care if you bill me as asshole, just pay me. And that Nick was his exact term.
Nick was a smart guy. I worked my last 14 years under Vince's thumb. A lot of people don't like Vince, and I'm not a big fan of Vince's either, but he was my boss. Yep, and this is what I got to say at the end of the 14 years, 7 as an agent and 7 running FCW. What I got to say is I put 2 kids through college. My son is a doctor. He has no student loans. My daughter is in IT and really high up on a ladder for her education. I paid for all of this stuff. I paid it because I got paid by Vince McMahon and the WWE. So I wouldn't want to hang out with Vince. We never hung out, or he didn't come over to my house and swim in the pool or nothing, you know, but do I respect? Yeah. Because it just what you're saying, George, the guy paid me so well. I'm doing my second book now, which is a continuation. My life went from my beginning of my life to 1987, the end of the Fabulous Ones. The second one picks up in 87. It goes through all the WWE, WWF, all of the, you know, just tours and the whole thing. Then the FCW of training and all the talent that there's now. I mean, everybody that's in WWE went through FCW originally. And when you look at all of that stuff, you go, wait a minute. Vince set this whole thing up. I mean, you know, I worked hard. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, he got his money's worth. And I mean, you know, he had me under so much pressure as an agent that, you know, the business was no longer fun to me. I mean, when you're a wrestler, it's fun because you're only responsible for that time you're in the ring and what happens. And it, get it over and you're out of there. You're in the dressing room. You're in the ring. You're done. And now you're on the road. So that was it. And it was a lot of fun. But when you're an agent, I mean, you're writing the report. You're running the show. You're counting the building. You're reporting to the office. You're doing everything. You start at 3 p.m. and don't shut down till 1 a.m. in the morning. And then you get on a plane and then you're running it again. And if you were like me, a lot of times I ran European tours and foreign tours like the Philippines and stuff. Now you're a babysitter. Now you're babysitting the talent, because guess who's responsible is, let's just say Randy Orton gets in trouble in Manila. Okay, who are they going to turn to first? Well, who's the agent? Turn. Get Kern on the phone. What are you doing letting the guy go out and get drunk? Like, I'm going to follow him? I mean, do I need to follow everybody? But I took the responsibility, and I got cussed real bad one time when I was calling a match at, I don't know if it was WrestleMania or Raw, but the talent got so nervous they started forgetting spots, and I'm calling it on a headset, staying two moves ahead of them for camera angles. And all of a sudden, they just take a left turn, and they're nowhere near where I'm talking. And Vince looks over at me, and he's got a headset on his monitor, and he moves it out of the way, and he goes, "Hey, Steve, what the hell are they doing?" And I look at him, man, and I got no answer. I just looked at him and says, "I don't know." And he's, when the end of the match came, he didn't wait for them to come through that curtain. He got up from that seat, and he said, "Step up." And I got up, and I went around in front of the monitors, and he got right here in my face, and he cussed me like a dog. I mean, he cussed me to the point that I was actually contemplating headbutting him. Then I started thinking about giving him a nut shot. And then I'm thinking, wait a minute. All of a sudden, I had a reality thing, and I said, "This is the guy that's writing my check."
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And then I said this. I said to him, I said, "You're absolutely right, Vince. It's 100% my fault. I'm going to do whatever I can to never let that happen again." Then he looked at me like a puppy, and he turned his head sideways and this way and looked at me. He goes, "All you need to say, Steve." And he went and sat down. It was over for him, but I was in shell shock. When I got in a car with Arn Anderson and Dean Malenko and Fit Finley, the agents, Lee, first thing Arn always said when we got in the car, that every night he'd turn around and go, "Okay, who got cussed tonight?" And I said, "I did." And Jerry Briscoe had said, "Man, he really cussed you out." I never had an experience like that, but I never held any of that against him because he's running a major company. And when we were there, when I was there in 91 as Skinner, everybody in the territory were top guys from all the regionalized territories. Yeah. I'd be on the first match with Ricky Steamboat or Kerry Von Erich, or the second or the third match, you know? I mean, it was no pecking order there except for Hogan. You know, and the top guys, which was great because the Housers were great. But, you know, it's like you just kind of accept things, you know. And
what
are you gonna say?
You give such a great example. And unfortunately, a lot of guys didn't do that.
Well,
There's
a lot of guys that aren't at peace.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I do these autograph signings. And when I sit down, they're either talking to me about sickness, injury, or being screwed over in the business and not getting a fair shake. Right. And I'm looking at him and going, you know, "Don't you know no jokes?" I mean, you know, I don't want to hear none of that. I don't want to hear nothing about anybody. And I'm going to pray for you if you're having problems, of course. And that's my deal. And it's hard to be a serious Christian because that you're always having a finger pointed at you and you're persecuted for righteousness. But my thing
I can relate to that.
I read the Bible, and I've read it 21 times. I read every day. And here's the thing. Twice, in Matthew and in Luke, Jesus says, acknowledge me publicly, and I will acknowledge you before my Father. I'm serious about what I do. So I never back off. I mean, you know, and there's a lot of people that aren't Christians in this business, and it's not like I can control that.
Right.
But that doesn't mean I'm going to shut up either. So,
right.
You know, and I'm just as guilty. I mean, you know, my past, I got a pastor that said it the best. He says, it's not where your heels have been. It's where your toes are pointed. And that's a good one for me.
That is good. Good. Yeah.
Yeah. That's because where my heels have been, my friends are skeptical when I do eulogies and stuff at funerals, and they go, wow, I didn't know you were so religious. And they go, what happened? You know? I said, well, I woke up to a lot of things. I woke up to realizing all the miracles I'd seen in my life and how my life was so blessed by traveling the world. I've been around the world so many times, and it's not braggadocious. It was a gift from God to show me everything and to open everything up to me. I'm not the most educated guy school-wise. When I started college, they asked me what I wanted to be, and I said, what makes the most money? And they go, well, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief. I mean, you know, well, I wasn't an Indian. So I said, I'm going to be a doctor. And I've signed up for pre-med. Well, you know, you have to have prerequisites when you go to college for pre-med. You need to know something before you get there. And every course I signed up for, they'd say, get your slide rule out or get your lab coat or get your microscope. And I'd just say, well, there's another class I'm quitting. And then when it came down to Eddie Graham breaking me into the business, he said, well, what do you want to do now? Because he was being my father, my dad being a prisoner of war. He was a prisoner of war from the time I was 13 to 21. So Eddie was a surrogate father that fit in. And Eddie would say, well, now what are you going to do? You didn't want to be a wrestler. I go, I guess I've changed my mind. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. You know, we really appreciate you coming on tonight, Steve. All your insight and experience. I've really enjoyed it. You're so humble and you're so real. That's what I really enjoy the most, is you call it like it is. You don't sugarcoat, but you're real and you're honest. And I really appreciate that.
I'd
like to leave the door open for you to come again sometime, be a guest again. And you know,
I've got nothing but time. I got five of the most beautiful grandkids in the world. I'm blessed. I got one child with beautiful. Three grandkids living 1 mile one way, and I've got my son living 2 miles the other way.
There you go.
Two kids. I mean, you know, my grandson just left. I didn't have the opportunity to spend as much time with my children as they grew up, but I did do a lot of family things like vacations and stuff with them. But I vowed to be the best grandpa ever.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of stiff at times because I believe in manners. I believe in being polite. I believe in yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, no, sir, please, thank you, may I? Don't go in the refrigerator. I mean, you know, take your hat off when you're at the dinner table. We're going to say the blessing. So, but they don't call me grandpa. They call me big daddy. And I mean, you know, so
I love it.
Well, before we go, I did want to show you this book here too. This book is another one that Ian Douglas wrote. It's called Bohemian Rhapsody. Of course, he wrote my book and he wrote five other wrestlers' books. But the reason I wanted to show you this is because that anybody that's watching, and you've got wrestling fans watching, anybody that watches and really loves wrestling history, people never got to witness the wrestling in the Bahamas. And there's 700 islands in the Bahamas, and I did because I'm a Florida boy, and I wrestled there a lot of times. I actually wrote the foreword to his book. But Ian really captures the history and a lot of the big stars, Kevin Sullivan, Dusty Rhodes. I mean, you know, it's endless of who went through the Bahamas.
Yeah. But
what a different atmosphere that was, only being 60 miles off of our coast right here, of way the wrestling fans acted. I mean, the cops had bamboo sticks that was like a wand and a little helmet. And the people, I've seen them riot so bad. They're throwing chairs like Frisbees, and the cops are just waving the little fans. But the actually arena that we wrestled in Nassau was nothing but a concrete building, 12 feet high, square, and on the top had chicken wire clear across the top. And it was because people would stand on the outside and lob rocks and bottles and all kinds of stuff. It was a wild place, but it's a very interesting read, you know. So, of course, my book's better, but his is
Yeah, right. Book. Yeah. Is he working on your second book with you as well?
I don't have I haven't put it out yet. Right now we're going over rough draft. Have with my writer. I dictate to him for 2 hours a week, and then he writes stuff down. And we already had completed it, and we haven't put the pictures in it because I really love pictures and wrestling history, and I've got great pictures that people never seen. And the other thing is until it comes out, I'm just, you know, it is coming out, but this one that you read now, everybody that's read it, including all my friends, and they said, man, that's easy reading. It's just like, you just kind of get into it and, you know, learning about something, and then you just kind of flows. And even I read it. I mean, you know, and the only book I read is the Bible, and I read my whole book. I mean, you know, so. But I'm actually in the final draft editing on it.
Okay,
And I you know what's happening? I'll be you know right up front with this is, I don't want to leave nothing out.
Yeah.
And when you spend 44 years of your life full time in an industry, there's a lot. And then all of a sudden, like I get knobs or somebody call me up and says, man, tell them about that rib when you ribbed me, when you painted on my back on Valentine's Day. And then tell them about when we were at Stephen King's house and I pushed you down a hill on a slide. I'm going like, you know, but people want to hear.
Yeah, right.
Maybe you have to have a third book.
This one is going to be interesting to you guys in AWA.
Yeah,
I pull my greatest rib in my history on Kurt Hennig.
He's a ribber.
But he wouldn't mess with me because we were best friends. And I had him arrested for statutory rape getting off an airplane in Memphis by about a 6'5", 455-pound redneck cop with an attitude. When Kurt got off the plane, we could walk out to the run. I mean, we could go out to the terminal at that time. Sure. And I snuck out there and was hiding behind a pole. And Kurt come off the plane all bouncing around in Memphis. And cop goes up to him and says, you Kurt Hennig? And Kurt goes, yes, sir. And he sticks out his hand to shake his hand like he was a fan. And the guy says, I don't want to shake your hand, boy. You're under arrest. And Kurt's going, what? And he goes, what for? And he says, well, read the warrant. And so Kurt started reading it. And I'm looking at it. It's statutory rape. And it's and it's a dad that swore out the warrant. I mean, I filled out the warrant. I even signed the part with the judge. The cops in Memphis were really close with the Fabulous Ones, and they were so much fun. I had more guys arrested for stuff. But Kurt, when he's reading it, he goes, I've never even been to Memphis. And the cop says real straight, he says, I've never arrested anybody as innocent either. You got two ways to leave this airport. Either you turn around, I'll handcuff you, we'll go get your bag and get in the car, or you refuse to turn around, and I'll beat your phony wrestling ass down and drag you through this airport. And Kurt just looked at him, you know, what are you going to say? And Kurt just goes, let's go. But you have to read the book to hear the
film. Well, we're going to read it.
Well,
you know, I want to read it because I told you I was on board with you from when you started in the business and right up to the end. So mine's coming. Amazon's going to be delivering it in a couple days.
I hope you enjoy it, George. I really appreciate you guys having me on too. You did a great show. And
I'll see you in St. Louis in May.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I'm not really looking forward to St. Louis, but I'm looking forward to going. I mean,
you know, well, I'm looking forward to meeting you in St. Louis.
I'll look forward to meeting you too.
All right.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's been great.
Thanks. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, one more time, Steve Kern, the fabulous one, Skinner. Thank you so much, sir. Appreciate
one thing it. I want to say. Am I still on?
Yes,
this
sir.
This is what I grew up with. Gordon Soley used to end his show the same way every time, and this was his tagline. So long from the Sunshine State.
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Steve. Folks, thank if you're you guys. Watching, thank you. If you're listening, thank you. And if you haven't subscribed, please do so. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, this is Total Package. Lex Luger. You're listening to the VOC Nation. Don't miss out.
VOC Nation's own Stro Maestro suffered a major medical and financial catastrophe this year. From the VOC Nation family, to all of you, please continue to pray for Stro Maestro for his continued recovery. You can also donate to his cause, paypal.me/PalpaStro. The worldwide leader in entertainment. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Check out In the Room
every Tuesday night at 9. Listen in.
Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Brady Hicks, former WCW star Stro Maestro, Kazzy Fist, Matt Grimm.
And you and Ray are there too, right, Ray?
We sure are, and we've got great guests like Lex Luger, AJ Styles, Taku, and more. It's a heck of a party. Plus,
I didn't get thrown off buildings.
And then
I didn't get pregnant either.
Sometimes I think it gets so ridiculous.
We were getting into like snuff film territory there.
In the Room.
9 p.m. Eastern on VOC Nation.
Yo, this is Jerry Stein of the Nasty Boys. Yeah, Brian Knobs here. You getting ready to get nasty? Well, listen to the VOC Nation, baby.
VOC Nation is one of the longest running wrestling podcast networks. Having started way back in 2010, VOC Nation provides daily streaming shows where fans have the ability to interact with their hosts and guests via phone calls, emails, and Twitter. VOC Nation hosts include former backstage interviewer from both AWA and WWE, Ken Resnick, former WCW performer The Maestro, former Impact performer Wes Crisco, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributor Brady Hicks, and former Philadelphia radio personality Bruce Works. Archive-free content includes past interviews with huge names like Hulk Hogan, Jesse Ventura, Kurt Angle, Jimmy Hart, Ricky Steamboat, Sting, Mick Foley, Joey Styles, Howard Finkel, and so many more. Listen live at VOCNation.com and subscribe to all the podcasts by searching VOC Nation Radio Network on your favorite podcast app. And be sure to follow these guys on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Phil After has been in the pro wrestling business for over 50 years.
Hey, Tony here with Arn Anderson. Arn, first of all, your height and weight.
6'1", 255.
And now subscribers to VOC Nation Premium get exclusive access to Bill After's archived audio footage.
And where's your hometown?
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay, and give us something about your back. First of all, your relationship to Ole Anderson.
Ole is my...
Subscription to VOC Nation Premium starts at just $3 a month and includes commercial-free audio and video versions of our top podcasts.
Okay, we're speaking here with the manager of the World Heavyweight Tag Team Champions, Tarzan Tyler and Luke Graham, and he's sort of glowing tonight about a new prospect we haven't heard of yet.
And for just $9 a month, After's archives are all yours.
Would you tell us who this new prospect
is? Well, I'll tell you, Bill, I've searched the world, and I finally found a true world champion. I finally found...
What's your opinion of Ivan Koloff winning the title from Bruno Sammartino?
Well, I think, I don't know what to say, but I want to say one thing. Bruno was a hell of a champion. You know?
Hear exclusive interviews with the greatest performers of all time.
This is Bill After, and once again, we're speaking here with Bruno Sammartino. Bruno, first of all, how did you and Bruiser lose that title to the Valiants?
Well, actually, it was a very unusual loss, if you want to call it a loss.
Didn't have anything to do?
Well, yes, but the whole thing is this, that the rules, as I always understood them, was that the title could only be lost by pin or submission, which is the same rules as my title, the World Wrestling Federation. That night, it was...
To sign up, it's very simple. head to premium.vocnation.com or go to patreon.com/vocnation. VOC Nation takes you behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history.
Each and every Thursday night, check it out. WCW star Stro Maestro takes you on a journey. It's WCW Retro, talking old school match of the week, talking dream matches, taking your calls and looking back on an incredible career of acting, entertaining, and wrestling. Check it out, VOCNation.com, WCW Retro. Be sure to call in Thursday nights, 9 Eastern, on the VOC Nation Radio Network.
This is Matt Hardy, and you are listening to the VOC Nation.